Hello, and welcome to Canada Reads American Style. This is Shauna.
Hi, this is Rebecca. And today we are so excited to introduce our interview with Dr. James Miskolic, who is the author of Life on the Ground Floor, Letters from the Edge of Emergency Medicine. And this is Dr. Miskolic's second book. His first one is the critically acclaimed 6 Months in Sudan.
Hi, Dr. Miskolic. Why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Sure. Yeah, I am, I suppose I'm not sure if I'm a writer first or an emergency doctor first, but I think writing came first in terms of loves, and emergency medicine is something that I learned to appreciate. So I do both things in about equal amount. I'm a teacher of emergency in Toronto and Ethiopia. I am on sabbatical from my clinical work, working on my third book. So I split my time between the two passions.
Wow, that's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. How long have you been practicing medicine before you decided to join MSF?
I started on the, a path in medicine at some point you must choose. And I started to become curious about the root causes of sickness and disease in medical school when I went to work in the public system in Santiago, Chile. And I saw that there was so much more sickness than I was used to seeing in my schooling in Canada. So at that time, as someone who was taught, not only is it your job to treat the person in front of you, their pain, their suffering, and their sickness, but you must also work towards mitigating the causes that led that person to seek your help, I realized that embedded in poverty was something that made people sick. So at that point, I decided that was a trajectory for me. Whatever kind of doctor that was the kind I wanted to be. So I started to look around to see what, was emblematic of that type of practice. And obviously Doctors Without Borders was the name that rang out on many people's, first on their lips and the people who've done it first in their hearts. So I started, kind of practicing that type of medicine really in medical school and in residency as well, when you're learning how to specialize. In my case, it was emergency. But MSF doesn't really want you until you have something to give, until you're ready to be able to work independently as part of a team, and they're pretty sure you're not going to freak out. So they liked you. It was about 2 years after I graduated from my specialty training program that I started working clinically for MSF, meaning as a doctor at the bedside, handing out pills to people with malaria. But a few months after I graduated, before I was in their minds ready to assume that kind of responsibility, I went away with them as a journalist. So I kind of did both things, so I was pretty new in both instances, both as a writer and as a clinician.
That's really interesting, because I've known a little bit about librarians also being a part of the they do overseas with the Peace Corps, and different librarians will go and visit other countries and help the developing worlds get their libraries up and running. So it's so fascinating to see it from a doctor's perspective. In your book, you reference not going there with the sense that you are there to solve their problems. Can you talk about the delicate balance between that?
Well, the biggest act of humanitarianism, I suppose, whether it's as a physician or a librarian or an engineer, is not necessarily coming at it from a perspective that you have an answer to what ails, these people who find themselves in these kind of extraordinary and difficult circumstances, but more as an act of solidarity and standing beside the people who are struggling or suffering a lack of resources or a lack of autonomy or a lack of agency, and feeling the weight of their pain and their suffering. And by that kind of show of camaraderie or humanity, kind of helps them feel less alone. So I think the delicate balance is not presuming to know the situation because you haven't lived in it, and going there thinking that you're going to save anybody is a certain type of hubris, I think, that is quickly lost by the weight of how difficult and complex these problems are. Now, on the other hand, what I think that, well, you're not there to help them solve their problems exactly, you are there to help mitigate the worst of the consequences of those problems. And if you're really true to the spirit of this type of work, I think you also help them by giving them an opportunity to create solutions to their own problems. You know, that may be looked by giving them health, by treating their sicknesses. It may be by helping them organize their activity if they're looking to improve access to healthcare for rural, you know, people who they hope to serve. So it is a fine balance between having enough kind of humility to learn from the people about what they need most.
Have you ever seen an example where somebody went in, a doctor, like a Western doctor went in and just was kind of pompous about it?
I mean, have I seen examples otherwise? I think they're probably less common in the, you know, in the other way. I don't mean to disdain the motives of the people who choose to go and help. I think it's good, but it is much more rare phenomenon for someone to show up to a place where a person is in need and spend enough time to develop trust and then ask the question, you know, in a way with no preference for the answer, how can I be of service? It's much more common to go in there and say, hey, you know, I'm an ER and trauma doctor. Where's the trauma room? I'm gonna start working on making this place, you know, spick and span, or getting some more supplies in there. And that might actually not be what that environment needs. It might not be what it needs at all. Maybe it needs a triage. Maybe you need to look at what stands in the way of those traumas coming to this ER. So it, you know, it's taken me a lifetime, truly 20 years, you know, so far of being a physician, to really just understand and that lesson. So I'm not saying that doctors are pompous or nurses or engineers or librarians. I'm just saying that it is that the needs are so great, and it just requires a certain slowing down, solidarity, and humility in order to develop the trust of the people enough then, and the slow, almost inertial, glacial change, incremental change that is lasting. Yeah.
Now, do you think that you experience more job stress in Ethiopia with like a lack of resources, or in Toronto with like the whole, like all of the volume of patients?
Well, you know, the Ethiopians experience more job stress than I do in Toronto. And the reason why I'm making that comparison is I have committed to, and I own in some small way, the system in Toronto. So, you know, I'm there to see patients, but I'm also there to respond to the changing needs of the population in Canada, because that's who licensed me, that's who trained me, and that's who my kind of clinical obligation is. Now, however, when I go to Ethiopia, are the demands much greater? I would say they're much greater. I would say that the sicknesses are much more serious. They happen in younger people. The families who endure them are more vulnerable because of the illness. They have much more is at stake in each case because there are fewer options. But the reason why I say that I bring up the Ethiopians who are working in that system is that that's their life. I have an exit visa. I can leave and tune out. I don't speak Amharic really. And I can hear in the wails of the people whose families are sick or their loved one is sick, pain. But it's not something that lingers with me in the same way. If this was my actual home and I saw such a great need and had such modest means with which to respond to it. So, you know, do I stand beside the bedside in Ethiopia? Yeah. You know, can I claim that it is as hard as it is to be an Ethiopian person seeking help or the ones who promise to help them? Definitely it's not. So I would say the stress in Toronto can be high. But what's at stake in Ethiopia in terms of not being able to meet the needs, that is certainly more dear. That's why I return. And, you know, it's perplexing and it's uncomfortable and it is hard on to reconcile with the world I see when I come back to Toronto. So I know that's a long answer and maybe I escaped the question, but I'm going to say that the Ethiopians feel that heat and weight even much more than I do.
No, I think that totally answers our question actually. And I will say, and because I don't think we've even said this up front yet, but I loved your book. I just got so much out of it. And one of the questions that we'll ask a little bit later is what you think your readers have gotten out of it. And then I'm going to throw out what I got out of it. But I do want to say when library staff, because we, Sean and I work in a library, I'm the library director. And when library staff make a mistake, I often just say to them, look, we're not saving lives here. We're just pushing books. Mm-hmm. But then I started thinking, wow, you really are saving lives. Mm-hmm. So how do you reconcile mistakes? Because I can't even imagine, you talk a little bit about it in the book, and I can't even imagine how, when you have that amount of responsibility for people's lives, how do you reconcile that?
Well, you know, I'm just going to say that saving lives is pretty rare, but it does happen. We do it. I mean, I'm not saying that we don't aspire to help people, but just in that rare instance, it's pretty rare that even as a clinician working in a downtown trauma center, you do something particularly yourself that changes a person's clinical outcome in the way that people think is common. It's actually just, it's quite rare, but but mistakes are common, however. So the stakes are high. There are a lot of fail-safes embedded in the system such that, you know, if I order a medication and I err on the dose, the nurse may catch it and vice versa. But it is real and we live with it. You know, I don't know what my life would be, what another life would look like. But so this is the only one I'm living. But it does, what is the solvent for the stress, at least for me, is my heartfelt intention, as much as possible, to truly slow down despite all the busyness that surrounds me and connect with the human being in front of me as tenderly as I would someone I love. And then I kind of have this intention that I'm going to try to help them as best I can. And once I'm amidst all the distractions, that kind of covenant that I make with the patient, amidst all the distractions, and double checking, triple checking, quadruple checking as often as you can, and really just knowing your stuff. You can't fake it. You can't fake it. You can't be at a downtown busy center with a lot of eyes and not know your stuff. You have to be actually at the top of your game. And that gets kind of tiring, actually. There's no hanging back in the pocket. There's no cutting corners. There's no like, I'm tired. I don't feel that great. I'm just going to kind of like laze around. And you can't half-ass it. It has to be totally, have to be on point the whole time. So, you know, the advantage is if I'm able to bring myself to practicing medicine at that level, which I should every time I go into work, and I'm able to do that and hustle for 8 hours. Once the 8 hours is done, I'm done. I leave it all behind, you know? So that's how we do it in the ERs. You show up as close to 100% as you can do. And then once you're done, you shut it off. So it's a strange life.
You do a lot of training, like you teach other doctors or doctors who are becoming doctors. I don't know. You teach them all of those things. Do you find that that's something that's easy? Not easy, but is that something that can be taught?
What?
Everything that he
it's not really a there's not a curriculum for loving kindness in medical school, but without it, I don't know how to practice medicine. And I mean by that, I should clarify. I don't bring loving kindness into every encounter. Okay, I try. All right. But people, you know, they can be abusive to you. They can be mean. You cannot connect with them. You can have your own stuff going on outside of the hospital or inside the hospital that's standing in the way of you doing it. But it is the default setting that enables you to do what you promise to do, which is turn someone's life around with the best of what you know. Because if you don't have that as a guiding principle, then I don't know why people are doing it. I don't know, money, yeah. Prestige, I don't know why. But those things are hollow. Those things are, there's nothing that is, if you do medicine, I appreciate that I'm talking to a country that doesn't have a public healthcare system. So I know that's a guiding principle for some of the insurance companies. I know it. But if you have that as, money, prestige, fear of legal consequences. So if you have these as guiding principles, then you're I don't know where your ethics stand. I don't know how to form something that you can resort to in times of crisis or in times of indecision that is going to help you act in the patient's best interest, which is what the person in the bed wants you to do. So if it's money, I don't know if you're gonna be able to act in that person's best interest. Or if it's prestige, again, I'm not sure. If it's fear of legal consequences, I think that you're gonna fall short as well too. So, you know, when I talk to residents and trainees, I do spend time defaulting to what the motivations are at the deepest and most fundamental level. And it has to be that sense of treating people like they're your family, really.
Yeah. I'm going to switch to the next question about Ethiopia, because I read recently, because I'm not really up on Ethiopia specifically, but that they have a woman president. And while I read that that's a ceremonial position, do you think things will be different with regard to medical care under at least having her in that position?
No, I think we both should check to see if she still is president. Because I know she was, and I know I think I read something that she may have that may have changed. But let's just move on to say would a woman in position of power change the face of health politics? I would say yes. You know, I would say naturally so. And I don't want to disdain men, and I am one. So I certainly have, you know, don't want to get into any kind of self-loathing vibes, but I think what I've seen in Ethiopia is a lot of the strongest leaders in the emergency medicine field, as new as it is, are women. When I work in global health in Toronto and Canada, a lot of the people I work with, the vast majority are women. So what does that mean? I suppose it means that maybe there is a natural sense of caring that is considered typical of the feminine, because of either having, you know, having cared for children or having been put in that role before. Maybe the ability to empathize with people is a little bit easier to do. And again, I'm not trying to say that men aren't capable of it. I'm just kind of wishing for change in a positive way. And I've seen so many instances of men in authority over the years, and I'm ready for a change, to be honest with you. I think that it could be come from embracing the feminine or giving women an opportunity to be health leaders, you know, and in places where, you know, if I could advocate for something that I think would work on both poverty and climate change in equal amounts, it would be educate people, young women in particular, girls and young women in particular, because you can give them autonomy to make their own decisions about how they want to live their life, you know, sexual power, all of these things. So it's possible that a woman in a position of authority in health politics would naturally have a deeper understanding of that than a man would. So
yeah, and we're still waiting for a female president in this country. So I hear
anytime
one of these days. I don't know if it'll happen in my lifetime, but my fingers are crossed still.
Oh God,
I know.
You know, I was very fascinated by the aspect of every chapter of your book. Now we're gonna talk more about your book now. Every chapter of your book is A through Z. You don't even skip a letter to try and do it. So I was curious, how did you come up with naming, or why did you name the chapters this way?
Yeah, you know, I'm a fan of structure, even though like when it gave me the bones from which to hang off like the scenes and the themes, I suppose. And it was sounded like an easy sell, but you know, of course, it became what seemed straightforward at the beginning, because you know, ABCs is how you teach basic life support or CPR techniques like airway, breathing, circulation. So I thought it'd be natural just to continue on. But what I thought was a convenience for device ended up being kind of restrictive in a way, because you know, every word starts with a different letter, you know what I mean? A K was like, should it be kilogram or king? Or you know, I was reading like the dictionary for like weeks, which is kind of cool, but it led to, you know, should it be, you know, roundabout for the place where I lived in Ethiopia? It could be really anything. So I liked the finitude of the alphabet. I liked the possibility, just like in that short story by Borges about the library, with all of the possible permutations of letters, and that the answer that will set us free is somehow in, you know, waiting to be written by these letters, you know, at least in the English language. So it created possibility and it gave me structure. And yeah, it ended up being a creative thing for me. You know, it gave the book a natural shape, which I ended up liking.
Well, I wanted to ask you also, what have you heard from the readers about what resonates most with them in your book? And then I'm going to tell you what resonated most with me, because I also heard an interview where you talked about, and you mentioned the thing that really hit me the most. So I'm just curious what you've heard from your readers about your book.
Well, I think everyone really liked my grandfather and the chapters that included him. I think that a common compliment that at least the, you know, I don't know if it's common or I paid attention to it the most, but typically the pacing was such that they read it in like great chunks, and sometimes you know, all at once, which is what I tried to create with both the narrative and the structure. You know, if I felt like I was introducing something that was either complex or kind of heavy or maybe too medical, then I would try to break it up with the scene to help propel the reader through this experience, because I wanted to make it intense and illuminative. And I wanted them to leave with an emotional experience from it. So typically they responded to my grandfather, like I mentioned. They appreciated the pacing and the structure. But what did you hear that in the interview, or what did you hear that resonated with you?
Okay, so when you said that, it reminded me of the other thing. So the first thing, yeah, I love the pacing, because I have to admit, I'm a real visual person. And I felt like when you were describing your time in Ethiopia, I just felt like I was there and I could picture what it all looked like, which was amazing, because you used very spare language, but it was still so descriptive that I felt like if you showed me a scene, I could go, yep, that's where it was set, because it was so visual in my mind. But the other thing that really kills me, and I said, I will never forget this the rest of my life, and I heard you talk about this in an interview, but when you talked about the woman who was walking with the dead baby, and you said it's what she's walking towards, oh, it just killed me, that whole story. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we're all walking towards, right? You know, something where a human being is going to live up to his or her promise about what we're capable of, about what humanity is capable of. And until that time, we're heartbroken, because we know what we're capable of. We know we can see that there's enough food, and we know that there's enough medicine, that people don't have to die abstractly from these things. And until, you know, when I got back from wherever it was, the first place I went away, or off the plane from Sudan, you see, no, I'm not going to call it failure, because there's beauty in the world, and grace and God and all those things, but just how we are and how we have yet to become, it seems such a great distance, what we're capable of and where we need to go in order to be who I believe we are at the deepest and most fundamental level. It's and into that distance, into that void, falls women and children and men and hope and love and laughter and all of those things. So we're all walking towards that place where something makes sense.
Yeah. Well, that was absolutely, I said that will live with me forever. That what you said about it and just that whole scene that you wrote about. But, you know, we're running out of time because we know you have somewhere you need to be. But we just wanted to ask you really quick, since you mentioned that you're working on your next book, we definitely, can you talk a little bit about what the next book is about?
Sure. It's kind of a continuing on this, if you consider this is a like a trilogy, maybe almost, where it the evolution of what matters to me, I suppose, as a person and as a physician. But if the first book was 6 months in Sudan was about, you know, the clinical act and get with this difficult world, and the second book, Ethiopia, was seeing that, you know, you really didn't need to go to the all the way to Sudan to find the suffering people. You could find them very much in your own ER, in your own body, in your own self, you know. And this, the third book is, I think, kind of a continuation of that. Where, and as it stands, it's kind of a compass of medicine. If the last book was the alphabet, this is the compass in all four directions. And so Western medicine, which I know the best, which is kind of like allopathic, which is anti-everything. You know, you have a fever, we give you anti-fever medicines. You have bacteria infection, we give you antibacterials, anti. We break the person down into really small pieces without that much attention to the human being that those kidneys are happen to be living in, or being, you know, are cultivating the life of. So from the Western medicine, the Western medical paradigm, my mother has leukemia. We're working through that. I'm traveling to India to look at Ayurvedic medicine and the greater attention to constitution and the spirit, to Tibet, to Peru and Amazon and the plant medicine and the many interactions with the ecology and environment that are alive in that type of healing tradition. And then to Canada's north, and the medicine wheel and its inclusion of, you know, kind of mind, body, spirit, community. And just to see, I don't disdain Western medicine. And I think that there's so much to love about it. And it's obviously the tradition with which I connect with the most. And it's the one in which I'm trained. But it has, you know, some foibles and flaws. You know, why are we trying to get people well? There's no underpinning of spiritual kind of recognition of what a person is at the deeper and most fundamental level. So I'm curious about looking at health and the body from all these different directions, what it will illuminate. What are these kind of different viewpoints all looking at? What is the compass needle spinning around? And I hope with that kind of discursive kind of view, a clear understanding of what we are, and ways that Western medicine can grow, what you know, grow again, make alive that no matter where you go, people are fundamentally after the same thing. And just write more or less an adventure story about what it's like to try to gain insight and understanding from all of these kind of enlightened practitioners who, like me, I think just have the best interest of their patients at heart and a different way of looking at the body and why it's put together and how it gets sick and how it gets better. So that sounds like a big project, but that's what I chose to do. So,
okay. Well, I have to say that is 100% the kind of thing I'm interested in. So we will be reading it, and hopefully we might be able to invite you to come back and talk to us after that book is published, because I think it sounds fabulous. So,
okay, cool. Well,
thank you so much.
I'm going to be writing a bit of a blog along the way, so you can check out my website at jamesmuskolic.com, and just kind of going to start that off probably later this month. So come along with me to India and check out these people.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you
so much. My pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us. And don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, Share, like, and tell all your friends about Canada Reads American Style.